What is missions? Well, putting boots on the ground, feet on the street, feet to your faith is part of it. Missions is the spearhead of the church. To proclaim the good news in places where Christ has not been heard of. Romans 15 verse 20. Missions is the front line of the church. As Joel 2 says, they attack like warriors. They climb the wall like soldiers. They all keep marching straight ahead, and they do not change direction or get in each other's way. The Lord thunders commands to his army. The troops that obey him are many and mighty. Missions is obedience to the Great Commission. Go then to all peoples everywhere and make them my disciples, Jesus said. Missions is the kingdom of God advancing. Jesus was given authority, honor, and royal power so that the people of all nations, all races, all languages would serve him. His authority would last forever and his kingdom would never end. Daniel 7:14. Missions is the church reaching the whole world for Jesus. The whole church reaching the whole world with the whole gospel. For this is the commandment that the Lord has given us. I've made you a light for the Gentiles so that all the world may be saved. Acts 13:47. Missions is the church in action. The believers who were scattered went everywhere preaching the message. Acts 8 verse 4. In Matthew 9 verse 35 to 38, our Lord Jesus Christ commands us to look at the fields which are ripe unto harvest. We need to look. How do we look? Well, you can read missionary newsletters, missionary books, study Operation World, 10 missionary conferences and report backs, rallies, Great Commission courses. Operation World is quite a phenomenon. When Patrick Johnson, who is a missionary in Dorothea Mission, doing film evangelism in Matabeleland in Rhodesia, he started using a Ronio machine to print off country reports, and there weren't really any around. And he used apple crates in the back of his bucky to organize files in different countries and put together analysis of 30 countries needing prayer for a day of prayer at the Dorothea Mission. And out of this grew the phenomenon of Operation World. Now, every publisher he took it to said, there's no market for prayer book on missions. Don't be ridiculous. And so he was turned down by the biggest names in publishing. In 2010, at the Cape Town 2010 conference, Lausanne 3, largest missions conference in the world, it was reported 15 million copies of Operation World in 8 editions had already been sold. 15 million. Not bad when there's no market for such a thing. And this started in South Africa and in Matabeleland of Rhodesia, what today is Zimbabwe, praying through every country in the world. In fact, our mission started through Operation World. It was through praying through Operation World that in our prayer meetings in the 6th South African Infantry that I saw Mozambique, not one Bible for 1,000 people. No one under 18 allowed in church. No missionaries allowed. The least evangelized country in the Southern Hemisphere, not even 4% of the people of Mozambique are Protestants. And it started to stir within me. I could take Bibles to Mozambique. I could take the Jesus form, which had just come out in 1980, into Mozambique in Portuguese. And get hold of a 60mm projector. And from praying through Operation World, I did, how could we meet some of this demand? How could we have right next to South Africa, the least evangelized country in the Southern Hemisphere? And what a change we've seen in the last 40 years. Mozambique now has 34% people who would call themselves evangelicals, Protestants, independents, Bible-believing Christians. And missions are legal, and Bibles are freely available, and people of all ages can be in church. What a transformation from the communist hellhole Mozambique was in 1982. And it was because of Operation World alerting Christians worldwide to that that made all the difference. Well, Patrick Johnson's also a board member of Frontline Fellowship. He's also the author of The Future of the Global Church, which is a phenomenal analysis of 2,000 years of history of the church, its trends, its possibilities, and projections into the future. You must look at the fields. That's a command. Look at the fields. And pray that the Lord will thrust out laborers into his harvest field. We should pray individually. We should pray in groups. We should pray as a congregation. for missions. And it's so important that we have a missionary vision, that we have a world vision. And all too often, prayers in churches, prayer meetings, are all about us. My needs, our immediate neighbor, family's needs, maybe. But seldom do you find churches that are houses of prayer for all nations, with a vision for all nations. And it's wonderful to go to a place like Back to the Bible Mission, where they literally will have prayer focuses on different nations. And each morning at devotions, a student will come up and will give what they've researched from Operation World about a given nation, whether it be Nepal or Liberia or whether it be Mongolia. And just to remind us of where the church is, where the church is persecuted, and where the needs are great, and where the harvest is large, the workers are very few. So where to pray? I know people who've said that when they come to a traffic light, instead of revving the engine and getting impatient, they pray for a person or for a country or for a mission. And in family prayer for the meals, they don't just thank the Lord for the meal, but they sometimes remember another country or missionary or friend that's in the field somewhere. So it's so important that we put before people the needs of areas and nations and people groups and missions. And then send. Pray the Lord the harvest to thrust out laborers into his harvest field. We need to help others to serve God. We need to support and encourage and care for missionaries that are in the field. And we need to mobilize our congregation to support those who go. It's all too often so that there's more people willing to go than people willing to send them. There's more people willing to go in the fields than churches willing to send and support them. And that's not the way it should be. So we need to look, we need to pray, and we need to send. And we need to go. When Jesus told his disciples to pray for laborers to be sent, they became the first answers to their prayers. And so we too need to be prepared to go, whether across the street or across the world or across the border. We need to go as witnesses and to make disciples. So the question was asked, what is missions? Well, there's a threefold goal of missions: to establish self-supporting, self-governing, self-propagating congregations. Just think of the goal of a family. The goal of a family is not to have a baby forever, but to see that baby grow up to become more and more self-sufficient, self-supportive, and to finally become an adult who will have their own family and be self-propagating, self-governing, self-supporting. And so it is with missions. We don't just want to have baby Christians in the cot needing to be bottle-fed the whole time and patted to stop them crying. We want them to grow up. We want baby Christians to grow into mature Christian warriors with the full armor of God. And so the goal of missions is not to do everything for the people that we bring to the Lord, but to help those people to do it all for themselves. In other words, we are scaffolding. We are temporary. The missionaries go in and must not stay there. They must actually get out the way, like the Apostle Paul. Leave the local church to grow and develop their own leaders and to become mature. It can be very dangerous if we do too much for others. Do for others what they can't do for themselves. So there are four stages of missionary activity. Firstly, there's the pioneer phase. When you plow the fields, you scatter the seed, you cultivate, you harvest. Pioneering is hard work, and sometimes it takes years. It was 7 years of hard work in India before William Carey baptized his first convert. It was 7 years in Burma before Adoniram and Ann Judson saw their first convert baptized. It was 7 years in China before the first Protestant missionary, Robert Morrison, had the joy of seeing his first Chinese convert baptized the Lord. Now, praise God, we don't always have such hard fields, and we see results very quickly. I don't know how many churches would be thrilled with a missionary who's in the field for 7 years before they got their first convert. But for pioneer missionaries, it's often a long time of hard slog before they see the first fruits. So the first stage of missionary activity is pioneering. Secondly, you get the parent phase, when you've led people to Christ and now you're busy discipling them. And so it is that you've got the new converts growing into disciples and becoming witnesses and evangelists, and you see that just as an appearance stage, a parent's got to know when they need to stop tying their children's shoelaces and let them tie their own shoelaces, when they can brush their own teeth, when they can choose what clothes they're going to wear that day, and on, they can do chores, they can help run a house, they can work in a garden. The goal of the parent is not to goo-goo-gaga the child all the way through their teen years. They have to let them grow, and at different stages you've got to recognize pulling back and letting them take responsibility. And so it is in missions. And it's very bad when you overdo the parent phase and overstay the welcome. And sometimes there's resistance, and it can be great rebellion when parents are over-controlling when there's time to allow their child to develop. So, I mean, just one example. As a brand new missionary on one of my first mission fields across the border, I had gone to Mozambique. Second time I was going through Zimbabwe to get to Mozambique, and I happened to stay at a missionary family, 1982, inside Zimbabwe, and boy, this man was bitter, 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 bitter. He said, I've wasted my life. 42 years I've been a missionary here in Zimbabwe, and all these people, my whole congregation, have just gone back to witchcraft and drunkenness and immorality and polygamy. And he said, I've wasted my life. And now, I knew next to nothing about anything. I was a brand new Christian, brand new missionary. What did I know? But I remember sitting there, and I was too afraid to say it, and I didn't say it, but I thought it. I thought, what was he doing 42 years in the same church? He apparently started this church and he stayed there, and here's the pastor of this church. He'd been in this village or this community and tribe for 42 years. Why was he the pastor of the congregation? Why hadn't he moved off and planted 7, 8 churches in the last 42 years? And I couldn't help but think, it's partly his fault, you know? In fact, what I did say to him was, are you sure they've gone back to it? Maybe they never left it. Maybe they weren't real converts at all. If his congregation is now openly, now that they've got a Marxist dictatorship of Robert Mugabe, maybe now they just felt free to let him see the fact that we've never left our polygamy, drunkenness, witchcraft, whatever it was, and all those things. And so I did say to him, are you sure they ever left it? And this man was just so bitter, he couldn't even think straight to even answer these things. And I just thought, whew, may God protect me from ever becoming like that. I mean, what a terrible thing to waste your life. And so you would not imagine you could waste your life in missions, but I think some people do. This man did something radically wrong. If he could pour 42 years into a congregation and find they've either gone back to or never left witchcraft, polygamy, drunkenness, and all these other things. So there are some bad parents out there. And I'm afraid there's a lot of Christians who've got prodigals as well. And they've got to look at themselves and say, what did I do wrong? And yet I've met many a parent who've said, and they're, you know, parents who've got a lot of children, and all their children are wayward and living dissolute lives and turned their back on the faith. And then this parent would say something to me like, we did our very best. And I had such skepticism in my heart, and I didn't say it, but I'd look and think, I doubt it. Who can say I've done my very best? I don't think I can say I've always done my very best at all. In fact, many times I've been very dissatisfied with what I think is my best and think that's not good enough. I could have done better. And so what person, what parent could possibly say, I've always done my very best? First thing I'm thinking is, person's a liar. They're not just lying to God, they're lying to themselves. Jesus said, no one is good except God alone. And at the end of the day, we should just be able to say, we're but unprofitable servants. The mentality of so many people who want to pat themselves on the back and say, I've always done my very best, or I'm a good person. Met people here, come to mission, and they describe themselves as good. Or you ask a person in the street, are you a good person? I'm a very good person. The self-deception out there is colossal. It's not just pagans who are self-deceiving. There's many Christian missionaries who are self-deceiving. So let's be careful that we're not parents or paternalistic too long. And so after pioneering and, praise God, becoming imparented, there enters the third stage in missions, which is partnership. Where now you've got a new church and now you're helping them to become self-supporting, self-governing, self-propagating. It's their church. We now are moving to being a partner. Just like in many cases, you see the parents stepping back, and as their children become their own parents and become their own leaders or setting up their own household, and they must try not to interfere too much. And I'm afraid there are a lot of mother-in-law jokes for good reason, because there's a lot of mother-in-laws who are absolute nightmares because they just have to keep interfering. And we've got to be careful that in missions we can be partners, where we can come alongside and help and encourage, because we've also been parents, and now they've been parents, and now we can sort of help guide and help, but generally on invitation. Which moves to the fourth stage of participant, when you are no longer the parent, you're no longer the pioneer, you're no longer the partner, you're now a participant. They are self-supporting, they are self-governing, they are self-propagating, but now you get invited back sometimes to help in a Bible college or conference. You cooperate with the local church and mutual projects. And quite a lot of our work in Frontline is divided between some place where we're pioneering, some place where we are actually parents, some place where we are partners, many places where we are participants, where we are just going in to help with some more resources and perhaps a leadership training on some specific area, putting them in touch with different folks. And it's so important to know the stages so that you don't smother people's initiative and creativity. So, to go over these again, four stages of missionary activity. There's the pioneer, parent, partner, and participant stage. Any questions or comments on this aspect on missions, our goal, self-supporting, self-governing, self-propagating congregations, where we move from being parent to partner and finally just to participant, where we are standing behind and helping, but we're not interfering, except by invitation. Yes.
Would you see a place in someone moving to another part of the globe to function in a pastoral role that is more long-term in that area? If, you know, in, I suppose in sort of the trajectory of more easy globe, you know, travel across the globe, and someone was to send you?
Well, I don't see that model in the Book of Acts, that's for sure. What I see in the Book of Acts is Paul and Barnabas and Timothy and Titus going out and establishing congregations and moving on and writing and revisiting and encouraging, but letting the local church develop their own leaders. I don't know that it would be ideal. There may be exceptions. There could be cases where that could be so, but I think the main biblical model that we get is of missionaries going in and, like scaffolding, helping to build a building, bring down a scaffolding, moving away, and letting the local church grow and develop its own unique character. And obviously we want to be biblical, but the best way of being biblical is good teaching. Teach them good principles when they're young, and later on we'll see the fruits of it. And sometimes they may need some counsel and help, but it should ideally be on their request. So I would think, what a waste of the example I gave of that pastor in Zimbabwe, who had come from overseas, had helped establish the congregation, and he was the pastor. And I don't know how long it took to get the church going, but he had been there 42 years, working with effectively one congregation. I think in that time he stifled how many potential local pastors and leaders. How do you grow if someone else is doing things for you? So I don't know that that's ideal at all. How can I, as a foreigner, be as good a pastor of a church in the Nuba Mountains as a Nuban can, just for example? So I don't know that that's... I think it's better to be always short-term, not long-term.
Even in your own country?
No, I'm talking about missions now. Look, you could be called to be a pastor. No, I mean, there are cases. For example, I know in America where an English pastor, as in from Great Britain, has been called to a church in America and is pastoring there. I suppose that's not too great a cultural bridge, but I'm sure there'd be some very funny... clashes between the English culture and the American culture. I don't know offhand in South Africa of a South African congregation that's got an American pastor, but that's not a huge cultural gap. But for me to say, try and have a South African pastor being a pastor of a Chinese congregation in Hong Kong, could that work? Maybe. I don't know if that's ideal. I don't think that would be the norm. That might be the exception. Generally speaking, missions can be very attractive when you've got a foreigner coming, because the foreigner is different, he's got different accent, there's interest, And so for us to help get something started, it's great, but are we the right people to continue to pastor that congregation? Once you've succeeded in the pioneer and parent stage, surely at a certain point you want them to develop their own leaders. Is it going to be healthy if you've got, say, an American pastor of a Vietnamese congregation? He might be the one to get it started. He might be a great guest speaker, but surely it would be ideal to have a Vietnamese pastor taking that Vietnamese congregation further. That's the general missiology, planting people's groups, church growth model. Yes?
I'm just thinking, to some places though, and some people, it might be a long-term call to get them even to that stage of having participants. If it's people who don't even have the Bible in their language, to get that translated, that could take already 5 years.
Correct.
That's not short-term.
Correct.
I'm
now,
you like not staying there and yes, making them dependent on you, but it's not always like that.
Yes, so if you talk about, let's speak about a congregation in Jarrah or Papua New Guinea, where they don't have a Bible in the language, they're not even literate yet. You're going in, you're learning language, you're reducing language to script, you are learning their language enough to translate the whole Bible into their language. This could be a 15-year project. Yes, I mean, I can envisage easily that a missionary might be in some country for 15, 18 years, helping to get them all the way through and leaving them with their own Bible. But I think once you start going to 30 and 40 years, that's too long. I think at some certain stage you want, maybe he should be moving down the road and starting another church with, now he's got the Bible and the languages. So I just think it's a waste of a good missionary to go to one place and stay in that one place beyond the point where now there's got to be some people who qualify to be deacons and elders and evangelists and pastors in the local church. If you keep doing it, you're going to prevent them from growing. I mean, just on a simple basis, like in our mission, I could still run every aspect of frontline fellowship camps and so on, but it's been my goal for most of the last 20 years to have selected someone from our mission who must lead the camp. Because, yeah, hey, I'm now in my 60s. I need to be trained next generation to be running the course, and I don't want to be doing things for others that they can do for themselves. There was a time that I always did the Bible draw. I always did the just a minute. I've got to pull my hands back, and I've got to let others thrive and grow in these things. I can't lead everything all the time. Is it helpful? I don't think it is helpful. It's so... There was a time when I led the PT and everything else in camps. That's not right. You must pull back and let local leaders develop. How else are people to grow if you do it all for them? You don't see the Apostle Paul or Timothy or Titus doing everything for the local people in the book of Acts. You see in the book of Acts a leadership that brings the people to maturity by withdrawing at the key stage. So, yes, I do understand that if you're talking about a place that doesn't even have a Bible yet, that's going to take a lot longer. Then you can't do what Paul was doing. Was he wasn't working on pioneer Bible translation into local languages. He was working with the Greek language. He was working with the lingua franca, and so he was planting churches. It was up to others to come afterwards and to translate the Bible into the local languages. So that's why he could be in a church for a few months to no more than 3 years at a time. But that's the Book of Acts model. Other comments?
There's, I don't know, messages out there where they speak out against short-term missions.
Are we going to get there? Yeah. Because there's a place for short-term if it's in a context of long-term goals and in association with and under guidance of either the local congregations or a full-time mission based in that area. But short-term missions outside of long-term goals can be very destructive and unhelpful. So we've got to be sure that our short-term missions are always alongside and under the direction of a long-term mission or local church. Yes?
So it takes plus minus 3 years to establish a church?
Well, again, it depends how many cultural barriers you're crossing. So if you are involved in, as the Paul was, he is going to people who he could speak their language, or at least a language that they understood, which was Greek. And so he's going in and he's They really speak the same language now. There's some cultural differences, but he's able to establish it. He could do it in 18 months normally. I think, Ephesus was established in 18 months and Corinth in 3 years. So nowhere was Paul there longer than 3 years. So that's the kind of general parameter I'm thinking of. And that's in days when your main transport was by foot or by wooden ship, sailing ships. So obviously transport was difficult and dangerous and took a long time. Just think of how the missionaries who evangelized Africa and Asia, it took David Livingston 3 months by boat to reach South Africa, and then took 4 months by foot to reach his mission station, Northern Cape. So it's 7 months before he reached his field. For William Carey, it took 6 months by boat for him to reach India. And he couldn't get a letter back in under a year, because it would take 6 months one way, 6 months the other way. The first missionary to China, Protestant missionary to China, Robert Morrison, took him 9 months to get to the field by boat before he could begin. Now, that just puts our time frames need to bear in mind that we can do things sometimes faster these days than was done before, because we've got all kinds of advantages. We've got printed pages, we've got audiovisual materials, we've got great transportation. But I mean, all that may help you, and it may speed up the process to some degree, but there's still relationship developing, there's character building, there's building up the relationships, discipling people. So that's going to take several months at least, possibly a couple of years in some cases. But if you're going to a place where it's a different language, different culture, they don't even have a written language, now you've got to translate the Bible into that, you know, Wycliffe Bible translators type things, now you're talking, as Elishka points out, over a decade. You can't do that much under 12 years. 15 years would be the average. 18 to 20 years is not impossible to get Old and New Testament translates into that language, and a fully functioning, self-sufficient church operational. So, yes, it depends where you're going and how literate the people are and what's already in that language.